Good morning, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on the House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the pledge. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States
of America. To the Republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eglin.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Representative McDonald.
McDonald, present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
We do have a quorum.
Quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the March 17th, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Berg, will you approve the minutes?
I approve the minutes, Chair.
Representative moves approval of the minutes from March 17th, 2021. Any comments or corrections? All those in favor of the approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Minutes are adopted. Before we get started, I want everyone to be mindful of the clock today. We have test fires on each of the bills, and I'm going to ask test fires and bill authors to keep their comments brief and concise. I'm also going to ask committee members to keep their comments short and encourage that they follow up with bill authors, test fires, or the departments afterwards for further information. We've allotted approximately 15 minutes for each bill. First bill on the agenda is House File 1085 from Representative Stevenson. I will move that House File 1085 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. We also have an author's amendment, the DE1. I will move the DE1. Representative Stevenson, would you like us to adopt the amendment before you explain the bill?
That'd be wonderful, Mr. Chair. This amendment gets the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it.
Thank you. All in favor of the adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to try and set a good example and be very brief here. The bill in front of you relates to how building permit fees are calculated. We are all aware, I'm sure, of the housing crisis we have in Minnesota, the high cost of housing, and how difficult it is for builders to build homes starter families can purchase. That's a complicated question. There's a lot of variables at play there. This is not the solution to all of the problems, but it is one piece of the puzzle, ensuring that building permit fees are not an obstacle and that they're a reasonable amount. I also think it's important from a transparency perspective. I can tell you that as someone who is doing some work on my house right now, I had kind of an XXX in my budget for a long time, trying to wonder what the permit fee would be, because on the current system of valuation, I wouldn't know really until I submitted my application. Under this bill, I would know from the very get-go how much my fee would be. So I think it is an important reform that should help us decrease the cost of new housing, help ease our housing crisis, and promote transparency. I'm grateful that the chair has agreed to hear the bill. I understand that there's some concerns that some members have about it, and I'm committed to continuing to work on the bill. So I think it's appropriate that it's being laid over. I do believe that I have a testifier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Chair Stevenson. First testifier is Nick Erickson, Director of Research, Regulatory Affairs, Housing First. Mr. Erickson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Erickson. I am the Director of Research and Regulatory Affairs for Housing First Minnesota, and I'm pleased to be here to speak in favor of House File 1085, a bill that ensures that our building permit fees are assessed in a fair, transparent, and consistent manner by removing the guesswork. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for his continued interest in this topic. This measure is one of many that, of course, was left unattended to last session as the COVID pandemic took hold. I do want to be brief since it is deadline, and this is a bit technical, so I'll stand for questions at the end. The amendment does address concerns that we have heard from local building officials, local elected officials, and the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Currently, this, as with the amendment, this bill focuses the square footage-based limitation on building permit fees to be focused solely on residential construction. Importantly, local control in terms of how a local municipality structures its fee schedule is unaffected by this bill. Under the current method, valuation is how we are assessed building permit fees. Of course, valuation currently is very subjective, but it shouldn't be. The value is not the assessed value of the property, does not include the land or in development improvements or even some of the finished carpentry services or appliances. Meaning that it's just really the structure, the sticks, bricks, and labor, if you will. And because of this, in any given geographic area, we should see with the same model home from the same builder, relatively the same valuation. There really shouldn't be any variances. Probably more than anyone, I have studied this for the past 2 years, and I can tell you with certainty, in the Twin Cities, the only thing consistent about valuation is that it's consistently increased in an inconsistent manner. After review of 2,000 building permits over the past 2 years from multiple builders in the metro using the same model homes, we've compared valuations. And 94% of the time, valuation is increased. No changes are roughly only 2% of the time. Decreases and unchanged valuations are roughly centered around a few municipalities. The lowest change observed was 9%. The highest we've seen was up to 123%. I know you received a handout. Was submitted. We have some examples of building permits where the valuation as submitted by the builder was changed. Also, an example detailing how with one home from the same builder in Shakopee had a valuation of $377,000, but in Lakeville, that exact same home had a valuation of $208,000. Same model home. And what we're seeing here is that valuation, and unless we're basing our system off guesswork from the local building officials, just simply is not going to be happening. And that's what this bill does. House File 1085 removes the guesswork. It moves us into something that is transparent, consistent, and fair. Thank you for your time. I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Next up is Daniel Lightfoot, League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. Lightfoot, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Oh, good morning, Chair Eklund, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. First, I'd like to thank Representative Stevenson for adopting the amendment. The amendment does narrow the scope of the bill by only applying this methodology to new one and two family dwellings, which addresses our concerns on issues that you'd see in the letter in your packets with commercial construction and remodel. However, the League of Minnesota Cities does still have concerns with the bill. Going to a cost per square foot methodology does oversimplify how building complexity impacts the permitting and inspections process. Currently, building fees are based on valuation, and that process begins with the contractor builder submitting estimated valuation, which, as Mr. Erickson pointed out, is often submitted lower than the actual valuation as determined by building valuation data tables provided by the International Code Council, which is the basis for how many cities determine the valuation. It is not guesswork. The complexity of the building, the amount of work being done in a remodel, and the ultimate valuation is based on actual data and inputs. Basing building permit fees on valuation is the best proxy to estimate how many inspections need to be done to most accurately estimate how the complexity impacts that level of inspections and the number of inspections. Basing building permit and inspection fees on a cost per square foot doesn't take into account that complexity. And I should also note that square footage is contemplated when determining the permit fee valuation table, and that fee schedule is public and available to builders and those who are interested in remodeling based on the fee schedule that the city adopts. I have with me today, Mr. Chair, members Brian Hoffman, who is a building official in the city of St. Louis Park, who can provide some additional technical details on our concerns with the bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair, members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. Next up is Brian Hoffman, Director of Building and Energy, City of St. Louis Park. Mr. Hoffman, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Certainly, and thank you very much, Chair Eklund and representatives. My name is Brian Hoffman. I do serve as the Director of the Building and Energy Department for the City of St. Louis Park. I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Building Officials Organization and here today with the LMC to testify on this bill. First, thank you very much once again, Representative Stevenson. The amendment does make this much more workable. Valuation has been used for a long time because it is applicable to so many different types of things, whether we're remodeling a floor on a hospital or an addition or a finish in a commercial building. So having square footage looking for single family permit calculation is certainly more feasible. And there might be one unintended consequence that going to a set permit fee per square foot brings into this. Valuation should take into account the amount of inspection work that's necessary to really reflect fee for service. And a 1,500 square foot starter home, very simple rectangular construction, cost less in materials and labor, and therefore value would be less. And it takes less to inspect than a 1,500 square foot architecturally designed, dream home for somebody with high vaulted ceilings, elaborate truss structures, cantilevered floors. And it might cost twice as much for that house, and the valuation would reflect that. If fees are set by square footage, what will happen is there's a median set. Basically, it would be the same permit fee whether that house was $100,000 or $200,000 if the square footage was the same. So there might be an inadvertency to make this regressive and therefore have a greater permit fee on a lower priced home than on a greater priced home. So that would be our concern. Certainly consistency, though, and fairness is what the builders are looking for. It's what building officials try, and of course the cities are trying to achieve by setting a fair and reasonable fee table. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Members, that's it. That's it for testifiers. Any member questions? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And whenever I think about building construction, my wife was a realtor for 16 years. Three words that always come into effect here: location, location, location. I mean, you can have a house in one area, fees and so forth can be one way, and another area in another way, or just across the river into Wisconsin, there can be a big difference in costs of the same home. So, I can't confirm where I stand right now if it's best just to go by square footage or look at some of the other variables that were just mentioned now too. That's interesting. So I went through this bill and I just have mixed feelings about it. Maybe there should be more things to take into consideration when developing the fee structure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, one thing that I learned in this, when we talk about valuation, it's kind of different, as I understand it. Mr. Erickson can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's not value of the whole property. You're looking at the bricks, sticks, and labor, the materials and what goes into building it. So, a property that's in a high value location because the land is more valuable, that doesn't come into the question of value for the purpose of setting permit. They look just at the value of the materials and the labor that goes into it. So that's just something to consider. So it really shouldn't be like if you build the same exact same house on a more valuable piece of property than another place, in theory, the permit should be the same. I think what Mr. Erickson would tell you is that that's not the case. And when I thought it was great testimony, and it shows that there is common ground here, that we all think that this should be consistent and it should be fair. The problem is it's not. That's not what's happening. That's what the research says. And so the idea here is to try and shift to something that is more objective, less subjective.
Representative Dever.
No, I'm fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Chair Stevenson, it looks like there is still a little bit of work to do. That's the reason for laying bills over, so we can work on it. I appreciate all the testifiers. Chair Stevenson, any final comments on the bill?
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for giving us some time on what is a busy day, and to members of the committee for the good discussion. It's a good bill, an important subject given the housing crisis we're facing in Minnesota, and I'm hopeful that we'll continue to work on it and possibly include it in an omnibus. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 1085, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Your bill is laid over. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and testifiers. Next bill on the agenda for today is House File 1042 from Representative Keeler. I will move that House File 1042 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. We do have an author's amendment, the A1. Representative Keeler, would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment changes some wording in here. In the original bill, it had just said members of recognized tribes, and we changed that language to match what we say across the board to say federally recognized tribes. And then the other piece that we changed is that this that we added a piece for individuals with tribal lineage or descendancy.
Any member questions on the amendment? All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Keeler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to enter into the space recognizing that the work that we do here is so important, and part of that is this cultural revitalization across our entire state. What this bill does is it provides a waiver for our indigenous population to be able to build homes in the format and the way that we have culturally and historically. I'm not going to take a whole lot of your time because I have phenomenal testifiers here today, and I know that we're on a time crunch, and so, Mr. Chair, I will move it over to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. First testifier is Jim Rock. Mr. Rock, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hamitakiapi. Hello, my relatives. I'm Jim Rock, governing council member of the Dakota nonprofit Makocha Ikikchupi. I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for allowing us to testify here today, and thank Representative Keeler for serving as our lead author for HF 1042. If I may share PowerPoint slides here, I'll try to share screen. Just a brief couple slides. Be able to see our logo?
Yeah, it's up, Mr. Rock.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, Makocha Ikikchupi. Our name means land recovery, and it is a reparative justice project because it is funded by settlers in Minnesota who are helping to make amends to Dakota people for Minnesota's policies of land theft, genocide, and ethnic cleansing. They do this by contributing to a land buyback project. With that recovered land, we hope to bring Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota people back to this part of our ancestral territory so that we can reconnect with our homeland and revitalize our culture and way of life. As part of this project, we turn to our ancient architectural traditions for inspiration, including the Earth Lodge, the third one on the left there, which is, we believe, the perfect housing solution to our sedentary lifestyle in our cold weather climate. Our executive director and her husband began experimenting with Earth Lodge building on the Lake Travis Reservation in South Dakota in 2017. The Earth Lodge is off-grid. It has no electricity or running water, and it requires a simple way of living. While they realized in the process that the lodge became a place for cultural revitalization, for gatherings and feasting, for singing and drumming, processing our foods and medicines, and passing on traditional knowledge and crafts. It is this cultural revitalization that we want to bring back to our nonprofit work in Minnesota, Minnesota Makoche. We purchased our first parcel of land just outside Granite Falls in 2019, and we were excited to begin building the Earth Lodges on site. We believed we would finally be able to start realizing our dream of bringing our relatives in exile back home. But in September of 2019, we were issued a stop work order by the city of Granite Falls for being out of compliance with Minnesota state building and fire codes. These codes were never written with Indigenous building practices in mind. After meeting with the city of Granite Falls, they ultimately supported our right to build Dakota Earth Lodges and to practice this aspect of our culture. In fact, they agreed to have their attorneys draft this legislation and help us get it passed. For our part, we agreed we would halt construction while seeking this legislative solution. And with that, I would like to introduce Crystal Johnson from the Grand Falls City Council to read their testimony. Nina Wolpida Chichiapido. Thank you.
Next up is Crystal Johnson. Ms. Johnson, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, my name is Crystal Johnson. I'm the city manager for Granite Falls, and I will be reading a signed written testimony from our mayor, Dave Smogluski, who sends his apologies. He's not able to participate in the discussion this morning. As he has written, I am writing to speak on behalf of my city and express our full support of this bill and our effort and the effort our friends at McCoy Ikakubi are undertaking to establish traditional Dakota housing on land that they own. This property is within the 2-mile limit of our city's building code enforcement zone. As such, our building inspector has the responsibility to ensure that all buildings within a 2-mile radius of city limits must comply with the latest uniform building code rules. The traditional Dakota buildings that our friends are proposing to build, although more substantial in many ways than standard buildings across the state, do not meet certain criteria of the Uniform Building Code. This bill would allow an exemption for these traditional Dakota buildings to be constructed and would provide a way for a building inspector to work with these good folks to properly ensure safety while recognizing their historic and traditional ways. The City of Granite Falls urges the committee to approve this bill as presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. That's it for the Representative Keeler. Is that the only two testifiers you have, or do you have more?
I believe that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Member questions or comments on the bill? Seeing no member questions or comments, the committee actually listened to me today. No, you've been very good. I'm just kidding. Representative Keeler, I like this. I like this bill. I like this idea that we can get some of our Native traditions maybe back into the state of Minnesota to show how people lived and want to live. Final comments on your bill, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pilame to everybody who is listening. As a Nakota woman, this is something that's really important to me. When I heard this bill, I feel as though I couldn't not carry this and be a voice for this because this is beneficial for our ancestors and our generations to come. I want to acknowledge the fact that this has bipartisan support, and I really appreciate the legislators who have reached out to me to have extensive conversations about it. And again, let's just continue to work together to do the very best that we can. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 1042, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
13 ayes and 0 nays. Representative Keeler, you're on your way to public safety. Next on the agenda is House File 1402, another Keeler bill. Representative Keeler, I'll move that House File 1402 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We also have an author's amendment, the A1. Would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment just adds the language that we missed in the original write-up, that this is designed for single and dual dwelling homes, not commercial homes. So that's what the amendment does.
All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Say nay. Motion carries and amendment is adopted. Representative Keeler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To another community that's really important to me, my home community of Moorhead. As many of you know, we partner right up to Fargo. And one of the things that we really strive to do is create a community that people want to plant their seeds, buy their houses, and grow. One of the barriers that we have because of this partnership, and we feel often like the little sister when it comes to Fargo, is that there are a couple building codes that make our homes more expensive, one of which is the frost footing. What this bill is asking is that we are allowed to create a frost depth that is aligned with the exact same depth as Fargo. I know that a lot of this is designed around weather, and Fargo is literally less than a mile away from us, and so we experience the same weather. So we're just hoping that this would be something that we could implement. With this change, it would start to be able to create a reduction in our cost of building. I will say that I had a really good conversation this morning with the Department of Labor. I know where they stand in this, and I respect that and appreciate that. And I feel like we have a really good plan moving forward to have conversations around this and other suggestions. With that, I'll send it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. First testifier is Jack Nyberg, building official, City of Moorhead. Mr. Nyberg, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Jack Nyberg. I'm the designated building official for the City of Moorhead. Have been for the last 6 years. I've been a certified building official in the state of Minnesota for 19 years. And when I was approached about this about a year ago, it was something that I could get behind because we have the exact same soil conditions on both sides of the Red River in Fargo and in Moorhead. And they're high plasticity clay soils. But we have a 54-inch frost depth across the river in Fargo, West Fargo, Horace, and the communities over there, and we have a 60-inch over here. And they've had that 4'6" frost depth over across the river in North Dakota since the 70s. And after talking to my counterparts, the building officials from the other communities across the river, you know, they haven't had any, you know, indication of problems because of the frost depth over there. And it does add cost to have that extra 6 inches of frost depth over across the river. And we're just trying to align the frost depth, you know, to try to help save some money. And, you know, with all the conversations over the past, you know, 3-4 years about affordable housing, it was just something that I wanted to get behind to see if we couldn't do something, you know, to save a few bucks for somebody. So I'm totally behind this bill, and I'm welcome to open to any questions that any committee members have. And I'll give it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Nyberg. Next testifier is Don Davert, President Davert Custom Homes. Mr. Davert, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Davert, Jr. I am the president of Davert Custom Homes. I've been building for now nearly 30 years, and another couple of months will be 30 years. And proud to say my team and myself are responsible for building well over 1,000 homes in Moorhead, Dilworth, Fargo, and the surrounding area. What's interesting, I agree 100% with building official Nyberg that our soils are very consistent with just a stone's throw across the river. And for some time we have been trying to find a way to get things more equitable. The most recent information as about from NHB this week that now if for our metro adjusted, for every $1,000 we're eliminating 200 people. So you can see that every little bit of, even if it's $3,000 a mile, what it's costing us to do this additional footing and frost or a foundation wall, it's really putting an undue burden on the workforce housing. You know, even though we will still have to do a taller wall, 60-inch on a more expensive home, that impact by percentage is a far less burden than someone who's really struggling to get into a $200,000 or, a workforce-type housing product. What's interesting, it can almost seem on the surface that what is the big deal? We're only talking, you know, six inches. But in fact, by the nature of how homes are constructed now, with the poured foundation walls of the aluminum or wood forms are 1 foot increments. So we have a 4 foot form. Hence, we, with our 10-inch footing, we can comply with our 54-inch coverage. We are forced to go all the way up to a 5-foot form with additional. So right from the get-go, we are jumping up a full 1 foot. We're not able to just jump that up. And some people may be confused to say, well, you know, if we just pour that footing a little bit thicker, we can comply. But the building code also requires us to drop the soil around the top of that foundation to prevent any unnecessary water intrusion, essentially up and over that foundation wall. By dropping that, that is decreasing the amount of frost protection. So we have no choice but to go up to a 5 foot panel with that nominal 10 inch or 12 inch footing. We have a very robust foundation system. By all intents and purposes, these single family and two family homes that we're building are classified by light construction. I know that is a very subjective term of light, but we are not building commercial buildings with this. We're not building high rises or any bigger structures. By and large, with wood framing, clad vinyl siding, maybe some masonry, sheetrock, the overall load or amount of weight placed on those is very, really insignificant for the way these are designed to carry this. Minnesota does require a number of other things, with including a one thing for the energy code, a foam on the outside of the foundations, a row of a more beefed up footing. So just that by itself, what we end up complying with the city of Minnesota, or the state of Minnesota, we have on one of our more entry-level homes in excess of $7,000, not counting what we're looking at for the additional $3,000. So as some of the testimony earlier today, talking about permit fees, why is one home valued or costing more in one city versus the other? Our homes literally across the river, only a nominal 300 feet, can be in excess of $10,000 before we can talk about land costs. And that, frankly, is a hard conversation to have with a young family asking why we're having to charge more for that. And, you know, there's just nothing that gets them excited about telling them that they have extra concrete in their home. They're very proud of their new home, but, you know, concrete just isn't something to really, I love concrete, but some people don't get too excited about it, so. In the essence of keeping this short, and I know you have a lot on the agenda today, I will wrap that up and gladly entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dever. You must have a pretty good arm, because I've seen the Red River there, and I couldn't make a stone across there, but thanks for your testimony. Next up is Scott McClellan, Director of Construction Codes and Licensing Division, Department of Labor Industry. Mr. McClellan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the State Building Official and Director of Construction Codes and Licensing, a division of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. And in fact, the department has had ongoing conversations for several years with various City of Moorhead staff and officials over the differences between the codes between Minnesota and Fargo, and we do, in fact, continue to remain sympathetic to their concerns to grow housing within their city in Moorhead. However, I do have to testify against this bill this morning, so I'll be brief and just make a few comments regarding that. First, it's important to point out that although not catastrophic, the effects of frost usually causes damage that homeowners are either unaware of or they learn to live with. Damage that nonetheless should not occur in a new house. Often it's not visible, as these often can occur in cracks below ground in the foundation that often just leads to undiagnosed water problems. We've seen that numerous times. When foundations shift, there can be visible damage as well, which is often occurs at garage floor aprons, their bearing blocks. Sometimes homeowners notice it in diagonal wall cracks at doorways. Where did these come from? Or at decks that are no longer level because the frost had lifted and shifted them, and then homeowners just learn to live with that. So just wanted to address what we're talking about when we refer to the damage from frost. But second, it's our agency's statutory charge to provide a building code that is uniform, specifically uniform throughout the state. in order to ensure consistent enforcement and to help lower construction costs, believe it or not, by creating a level playing field, and yes, within the state of Minnesota. Third, any proposed change to the frost zone should be based on science and input from other impacted parties. And to that point, changes such as this should be vetted through the experts and the stakeholders that sit on the Construction Codes Advisory Council that the Department of Labor and Industry chairs. It's their statutory charge to review and comment on all codes and laws that affect building construction, such as if a change is warranted for Moorhead, it should also be available for other persons in that region as well. So to that point, in closing, if the proponents are willing, I welcome the opportunity to bring this discussion, these and other concerns to the Construction Codes Council, where as chair, I would personally assist them in navigating that process for this subject or any other areas of discussion that might be helpful. So thank you this morning for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Representative Keeler, is that your it for your testifiers?
I believe that's it, Mr. Chair.
Member questions. Representative Nelson. Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair. And I guess the only question I really have is, would this, as Moorhead were to expand, would this zone expand around Moorhead? And I guess how far out would it end up going? I do have some concerns about this, but when we're talking 6 inches, I'm not as concerned about it. And I'm probably the only person on this committee who's ever put a footing in, who's ever built that as a carpenter. I have that fact that there was a building over, it was just addition to a school over here in St. Paul that we broke ground on President's Day, and it was 10 below, and we digging and putting the footings in. So I'm probably the only one here has done that and understands some of what Mr. McClellan talked about. But I think 6 inches, if they're getting away with it in the other side of the river, it probably is okay on this side. But I do have some concerns, and I think that the uniformity of the building code is probably something we want to maintain. And if there's a process to go through the Department of Labor and Industry to fix this, I think they should probably do that. But I probably will support the bill.
Representative Keeler or testifiers, comments on Representative Chair Nelson's question.
Mr. Chair, I can start and then I'll pass it over to somebody from our city. But thank you for the question, Representative Nelson. For this bill, it's designed for a township that's a border city. So I think at this point, that's what we're looking at, but I agree with you that, I mean, maybe there needs to be further examination of the region. I think that's one of the things when we talk about, Minnesota as a whole, that we often talk about the metropolitan area and then greater Minnesota. And this is just one of those areas that border cities really need some support in. At this time, I'll pass it over to Lisa, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nyberg.
I believe Representative Keeler is passing it to me, Chair Eklund.
Oh, I apologize. Yep, go ahead. Please add
thank you, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. Representative Keeler, my name is Lisa Bodie. I am the Governmental Affairs Director for the City of Moorhead, and I'll just clarify that border cities are defined in statute already. They include the cities of Moorhead, Dilworth, East Grand Forks, Breckenridge, and Ortonville. And the cities that are affected by the difference in frost footing depth by their contiguous city, which is noted within our bill, are the cities of Dilworth, Moorhead, and Breckenridge. And so those are the cities where the 6-inch difference is applicable, and they are contiguous to the North Dakota jurisdiction. So we're not extending out, as in some of the Senate hearings that we've had on this bill, they've noted that, you know, soils can be different 30 miles away, and we're not making any assumptions based on cities that are not within our immediate area. They have to be contiguous. So it is a very, very narrow exception for these three communities that have this 6-inch difference, which you know, causes the $3,000 difference in cost without, as Mr. Nyberg and Mr. Dabbert indicated, without compromising quality. Thank you.
Chair Nelson.
Like I said, I had some concerns when I originally read this bill, and after looking into it and getting some more information, I'm not as concerned. But I do think we need to have a uniform code, and I think we need to probably want to have this go through the procedure with the Department of Labor and Industry with the building codes piece and look at it. And if there's a legitimate reason for it, go with it. But like I said, I'm probably going to support the bill.
Any other member comments? Representative Keeler, I will echo Chair Nelson's comments. I think that the city of Moorhead and the other contiguous cities should probably have some conversations with the Construction Code Advisory Council on this, but the bill on the face of it seems to make sense if we can get those concerns addressed. Representative Keeler, any final addressed? Representative Keeler, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for listening. I will say that I'm working on building a strong relationship with the Department of Labor so that we can continue to work forward to do the very best that we can for Moorhead. Again, we talk a lot about affordable housing, and we talk a lot about how we keep people in Minnesota, and this is just one of the things that we feel like in our communities we can do. And so I appreciate anybody's support. And also, if there's any of you like Representative Nelson who are more familiar in this area, any input down the road would be extremely helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I will renew my motion that House File 1402 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Next on the agenda on the bill is House File next bill on the agenda is House File 1229 with Representative Bliss. Representative Bliss, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would. Thank you.
Representative Bliss moves that House File 1229 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We have several amendments. The first one up is mine. And I will move the H1229A1 amendment. This appropriates $50,000 in fiscal year 2022 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs for a grant on Veterans on the Lake for expense-related retreats for veterans, including therapy, transportation, and activities. What this is going to do, Veterans on the Lake have been working hard to get all their places in ADA compliance, and this grant will help make that happen if it is within our targets. Any questions on the A1 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Motion carries. We now have the A2 amendment from Representative Detmer. Please, Representative Detmer, please explain your amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Representative Bliss for accepting this as a friendly amendment. You know, the disabled vets camp on Big Marine Lake and Forest Lake, they have some needs to make some additions to the camp for security purposes and some fencing. This camp dates back to 1926. It was an overflow for the veterans VA hospital to treat World War I veterans. So it's a very historic camp. And over the years, the legislature has helped this camp out. And they've come to me again to they want to make some more security additions to the camp. Right next to the camp is a big county park. And what happens many times, people from the park thinking that this is part of the park, and they find their way onto the campgrounds. And it is a campground for veterans. And you have to have the honorably discharged and or a serving veteran. And now we're seeing a lot of younger veteran families coming and utilizing the park. There's 167 RV sites, 15 tent sites, cabin rentals, boat rentals, golf cart rentals, and a big marina. The Marine Corps came in and put in a beach for swimming beach for the kids. and there's a boat, there's a launch there, and it's a great place for veterans and their families, and we see more and more young veterans now utilizing the park. So thank you, Mr. Representative Bliss.
Any comments on A2 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All say nay. Motion carries. Representative, to your bill. The amendments are longer than the bill. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill was to allot $75,000 in fiscal year 22 and $75,000 in fiscal year 2023 to Camp Bliss Veterans Retreat in Walker, Minnesota. And I just want to say on the outside, even though the camp is named after me with a big giant statue in front welcoming everybody. No, just kidding. The camp has no affiliation to my family or myself whatsoever, and it is a really good retreat. And I do have a testifier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next up, testifier is Kara Ruff, Executive Director of Independent Lifestyles Incorporated. Ms. Ruff, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss and members. I'm Kara Ruff. I'm the Executive Director of Independent Lifestyles and Camp Bliss. I'm here today with a veteran testimonial at the end today because veterans in Minnesota are frankly in crisis, and they need community-based, effective, and efficient services and supports that are community-based. However, the clock is ticking. We're still losing about 20 veterans a day, 20 to 22 veterans a day to suicide. They're not in port resources or assistance they need to during and after deployment. The VA is overworked and simply cannot provide the community-based supports that veterans need to function within their families, employment, and communities. We keep pouring millions of dollars into reacting to veteran crisis, mostly in the form of high-cost medical and mental health care. I urge the Minnesota State Legislature to fund Camp Bliss so that we can continue to provide wellness and therapeutic experiences that provide lasting change, save marriages, create wellness and resiliency, and provide the important social networks that veterans need to thrive and so that crisis can be avoided. What hundreds of veterans have told me over the last several years is that they need more community-based options. They need opportunities to express their deepest grief and trauma, where it will not be added to their service record. They need confidential opportunities to be vulnerable, to heal, to bond with other service members with shared experiences. And they don't feel that those are being met right now. They want more community-based supports. Often when soldiers return home from deployment, they may fear that the worst is over. They're not afraid to die anymore in combat. But many are still unprepared for civilian life, especially having acquired trauma or a disability. A VA statement underlined just how complex of an epidemic it really is. Officials in charge explain that the department is simply incapable of addressing the issue and that it needs help from the private sector to properly tackle it. Dr. Richard Stone, the executive in charge of Veterans Health Administration, said, "We cannot do this alone, and we call on our community partners to join us in this effort." Camp Bliss is here to answer that call to action. Without any direct veterans funding, we have been providing health and wellness retreats to veterans for the past 5 years. At Camp Bliss, the veterans are in charge. We create and customize, facilitate customized retreats based on the feedback we receive, and therefore provide a wide array of services to help our veterans gain the level of support that they deserve. That array of services includes retreats for PTSD, Gold Star families, veterans and spouses, suicide prevention, caregivers, and much, much more. The wellness retreats for our female veterans have also exploded as the female veteran population has been significantly overlooked and underserved. With just $75,000 in funding, we can serve between 100 and 120 veterans and their families with life-changing experiences every year. We conduct pre- and post-evaluations to monitor health and well-being and gather their feedback at every opportunity. We are accountable and we are transparent. We created Camp Bliss with no direct funding for veteran services. We did it because not doing it would be an outrage. It was and is the right thing to do. It's time for Minnesota to invest in what is truly working in our communities, what is cost effective, and what prevents the exploding medical costs. Mr. Chair and members, I respectfully ask for your support in funding House File 1227 and would like to share two testimonial videos with you.
My name is Tracy Peacock. I'm a retired Marine Corps officer. I joined the Marine Corps in 1984, retired in 2005, and then subsequent to that, I came back to the St. Cloud area and worked as a police officer, recently retired. During the time that I went up to Camp West, we had the group that we had. It was a great group. It was a smaller group, and I think that's probably part of the key to it, is the smallness of a group that kind of bonds everybody together and makes it a memorable event. Very helpful. A lot of us came out of there with a new perspective on things and the ability to look at things a little bit different than we did when we were out there. It gives them a chance to express themselves to the staff that were tremendous and helped everybody out. Gave us a venue that was absolutely spectacular and allowed us to express what we needed to talk about and amongst ourselves and in a lot of ways, even to educate the staff and help them understand us so that in the future they can turn around and educate others about what these people have gone through, why they're the way they are, why they are different, because our experiences have changed us. We are different. And in some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad, and regretfully sometimes, you can come back and you're a different person. But it's key to have that group of people around you that you may not have served with directly, but they all serve. It's all the same for the greater cause. And you all understand each other because you've all gone through similar training and you all in services. And you all are there for a reason that you felt you should be there for when you volunteer to do it. The 3 days that I spent up there at Camp West, there's a great feeling of camaraderie that you are likely not going to find unless you have a reunion with your old unit. Kind of interesting. And I would dare to venture that any service that you are part of, when you go up there, you're going to feel at home. And that's kind of key. And there's kind of a home atmosphere. And I think that is probably one of the keys that allows people to sit and open up a little bit and talk about their experiences. I would hope that in this day and age, that our government, particularly our state legislature, would find it upon themselves and understand that this is a huge asset to veterans. I'd actually like to see the word get out a lot more about this organization and facility up there. In some ways, I don't, because I'm selfish, and I like the small groups up there, and just the whole environment of it is kind of the ability to go and grab one of your buddies and go out for a walk somewhere, like we did a couple times, and we didn't see anybody. And there was one car went down on one of the roads from one of the people's other side. Great facility, and in talking with the group, we're also in touch that I went up there with. We're planning on going back up there again when we can have us to do just a second check to see how everybody's doing. And we're also in contact with them as well, texting them back and forth. And I think everybody came back from that and just kind of sat there and said, wow, this venue made a huge difference. And I think the key to it is the fact that it is kind of out of nowhere and it does give you a sense of, okay, I can let my guard down a little bit because I'm out in the middle of nowhere and with people that kind of get it, understand what's going on, and I've got good staff here at the facility. It's a great environment. I don't think there's anything like it that I'm aware of in the country, certainly not in Minnesota, that I'm sure.
Ms. Ruff, that last one was very hard to hear. If I hope the volume is better on this one. If it isn't, could you share both videos with the committee administrator and he makes sure it gets in our packets?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Hello. My name is Steve Cornett. I'm the combat veteran and fire law enforcement. I've been with the cops for about a year. And I would like to talk a little bit about Catholic. You know, when I first got there, just driving across the bridge onto the property, the power of they had for the, just looking at the place, the power it had for heating. And you know, that's something in itself, not to mention the staff, makes you feel so at home and so welcome. And the camaraderie that you get with other veterans, knowing that you're not the only one that bad things happen to you on another day. The things that you go through. The stories that other veterans tell, and when you tell your story, it's phenomenal. I spent 4.5 years in Iraq, and the things that I've seen over there, you don't feel judged when you talk to other veterans about things that you went through. Everybody just unloads to each other. There's nothing better than helping a veteran than another veteran, knowing that what you have together is kind of a brotherhood or a sisterhood. And Camp Bliss really brings that out. It really is phenomenal with the things that the Camp Bliss helps with veterans do. Like I say, the beautiful landscaping, the buildings, the staff, everything you just automatically start feeling the minute you get there. And I would suggest to anybody to do what they can to help find Camp Bliss and help with Camp Bliss. There's no telling how many lives are saved with what Camp Bliss does for veterans. I know this on the stage. It's a wonderful place, and we have to keep doing it. It has to keep going. So that's kind of my story that I can't live, and I'm going to be going up there as much as I can.
Thank you, Ms. Ruff. Any questions or comments from members? Representative Bliss, we have both have an easy day going today. Representative Bliss, any final remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would I appreciate all the testimony, and thank you, Ms. Ruff, and thank you for your support.
Representative Bliss renews his motion that House File 1229, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Final bill on the agenda today is House File 439 from Representative Jay Zhang. Unfortunately, Representative Zhang is not able to join us today, so Representative Hassan is going to present the bill on his behalf. I will move that House File 439 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hassan, welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm sure you were expecting Rep. Zhang for this presentation, but as you can see, I'm not him. I'll tell you that Rep. Zhang regrets that he couldn't be here today as he's engaged in a family emergence. I may not do justice presenting this bill today as it would be lacking his spirit and passion. However, I promise to do my best to give you an overview, and thank God there are others on the Zoom call who would give you more details. Throughout our history, we have left out groups of people without rulemaking, whether it's intentional or unintentional. The disability community is one of those groups we have left behind, as their voices are normally not at the table to fully advocate for their needs and voice their concerns. House File 439 intends to fix some of that and be sure that we eliminate subminimum wage. House File 439 creates a task force to look at the issue of sheltered workshops in Minnesota that employ workers with disabilities and pay less than minimum wage. More than that, looking at the sheltered workshops, the task force would be charged with developing and implementing a plan to completely eliminate workplaces that pay subminimum wage. Under the bill, the task force would be compromised of at least 16 members. And I'm not going to go down the list. I think this is listed on the bill. Among other things that the task force must do, they must develop and implement a plan to phase out subminimum wage by August 1st, 2025, identify the barriers and the benefits of phasing out sheltered workshops with subminimum wage, identify initiatives to support employment opportunities for people with disabilities, and make recommendations for resources and support for people with disabilities, including training. Perhaps the most significant part of this bill is the repeal of the statutory provision and the DALI administrative rules that authorize certain employees to pay less than minimum wage to disabled workers. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe I have a couple testifiers and we will stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. First testifier is Noah McCourt. Mr. McCourt, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Mr. McCourt, are you there? Well, we're waiting for Mr. McCourt. We'll move on.
Mr. Chair, I was. Yes. He is. There you go. Here he is.
Yes,
Mr. McCourt, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. McCourt?
Sorry, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, having technical difficulties. Mr. Chair, my name is Noah McCourt. I'm one of the co-chairmen of the 4 Cents an Hour Coalition, an 100% disability-led coalition that's committed to the phase-out of the subminimum wage and fair and equitable employment opportunities for Minnesotans with disabilities. Well, I appreciate, the accolades of many of my colleagues on this issue. I think it's important to note that the conversation here didn't start, even though they start with us or with me. It started with national advocacy organizations calling for and recommending that the Department of Labor impose a moratorium on the issuance of any new 14C certificates and enforce existing laws that were being violated. It's undeniable that this was designed as a first step towards the total elimination of 14C. Some people will testify before this body today about the importance of maintaining the choice or the option to work for subminimum wages. The belief that someone would choose to make less money for their work is in and of itself an example of how certificate holders view people with disabilities. They don't think that Minnesotans with disabilities are whole people capable of making even the most basic decisions beneficial to themselves. And as you examine this issue, I urge you not to lose sight of the ultimate goals here, and that is the advancement of civil rights and employment protections for Minnesotans with disabilities. The ADA became the law of the land to ensure the equality of opportunity, full participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. Each of these policy goals is completely compromised by the practice of continuing to pay people under minimum wage. It deserves to be acknowledged that the concept of 14C originated in the 1930s when nobody had any constitutionally protected civil rights, including people with disabilities. Anything done for people with disabilities in the 1930s like affording them the opportunity to earn pennies an hour is simply charity, because the lack of belief in people with disabilities at that time that has continued into today. However, today in 2020, you know, and in our society, people with disabilities have come to expect far more out of their lives than was historically allowed. We have different words for opportunity to work for pennies an hour, words like discrimination and exploitation. I could go into the legal protections here, but for the sake of time, I'd rather note the legal protections here that do not exist.
Mr. McCourt, we seem to have lost you.
To understand what protections are lacking, it's important to think deeper than the doublespeak and the narrative perpetuated by many of these providers, many of whom you'll hear from shortly. On one hand, providers will refer to people with disabilities they serve as workers. And on the other hand,
Mr. McCourt, we can't hear most of your testimony. Can you please figure out your connection or submit it in writing?
Yeah, I'll submit it in writing, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
That's okay. It's a brave new world of Zoom. We understand we all have technical difficulties. Okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCourt. Next up is James S. Clapper. Mr. Clapper, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman Eklund and members of the committee, my name is Jim Clapper. I'm a parent of a young man with intellectual and developmental disabilities who receives MA waivered support for both residential and employment services. Thank you for taking my testimony. My son, Bob, who's in my background behind me in his job at Kowalski's, has been happily employed since 2008 in a number of positions, all made possible under the provisions of 14C of the Fair Labor and Standards Act. He started his employment in a center-based employment program doing light assembly and packaging work in a day training and rehabilitation program near our home. His wages at that time were about $2.35 per hour, which were commensurate with his level of productivity. This is about 35% of what the minimum wage was at that time. Today, he works on a mobile work crew in the community at Kowalski's, and earns about $7.88 per hour, which is about 85% of the current applicable minimum wage. Again, commensurate with his level of productivity. He has almost tripled his productivity in this time and moved from a center-based employment setting to a community-based employment setting. And we're very proud of his progress. Bob is very proud of himself too, even though he does not have a firm grasp of money. His income helps support his food and living expenses and does reduce his support costs from other state and federal entitlements. The 14C provisions provided Bob with choices and opportunities to start his employment and then steadily develop his skills and work ethic over the last 13 years. If the restrictions of HF 439 had been in place in 2008, he would have only life enrichment activities and his day training and rehabilitation program. In addition, customers that contract out for this work would have moved away from disability employment programs in order to compete. Bob's story represents about 7,000 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Minnesota who are thriving under the provisions of 14C and will lose their employment if HF 439 passes in its current form. On behalf of my son, Bob, I ask you to reject HF 439. Not only will this bill reduce employment opportunities, it will establish another expensive and bureaucratic process which will be redundant with what already exists. I implore you to avoid fixing something that is not broken. Commensurate wages with 14C provisions work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clapper. Next up is Julie St. Marie Bingham and Marissa Bingham. Please identify yourselves for the record and proceed. Ms. Bingham, are you there?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe they've joined the meeting yet. I'll keep an eye out, though.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reese. Next up are Don and Laura, and I'll get this name wrong, Kobokovich. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. I am Don Kobokovich, and this is my daughter, Laura Kobokovich. I am a retired special education teacher who lives in rural northern Minnesota. I'm here today to urge you to oppose House File 439. In contrast to what Mr. McCourt shared with you, it is because I value my daughter as a whole person, because without 14C provisions, she would not be able to work at all. The severity of her disability is like thousands of other people in Minnesota. Have behavior disorders, mental health disorders, autism, just a whole slew of abilities and disabilities that affect their ability to be in a mainstream competitive employment setting. It does not work for all people. But like many people, Laura has mixed abilities. And I'm going to let her start by sharing her story, why she believes we need a full range of employment options from completely supported work settings that provide commensurate wages that are ability-based, which is what 14C does. And I also urge you to understand the law that 14C, these clients have to be tested twice a year for their rate of ability. And as Mr. Clapper testified, his son's growth over the years has increased, and with higher ability, higher pay. So if a person's already working at an average ability level, they should be earning minimum wage by law, by 14C law. It is actually an old law, but just like our Constitution, it's a law that has stood the test of time. So Laura, why don't you go ahead and share with them a little bit about yourself and tell them why you need to have a supported work setting.
Welcome to the committee, Laura.
My name is Laura Kovakovich, and I am 29 years old, and I can't and don't want to work in the competitive community because I have vision problems and high anxiety disorders, which causes me to get anxious and upset easily. And if I am not in a safe work center, people might bully me because of my disabilities, and job supervisors who don't understand my disabilities would not know what to do if I become anxious or upset easily, and that's why I need a supported work center. I work at the Howard County DAC in Park Rapids in the Bailey Youth Thrift Store, where I do all kinds of different jobs, such as pricing items, filing office papers, and making stripping balls for the rug weavers, and they have a lot of job supervisors there, like Linda Kay and Nancy and Richard, who understand my disabilities, so they would know what to do if I become upset or anxious. I love my jobs because a lot of my coworkers have disabilities just like I do, and they have become my friends. If I could no longer work at the DAC, I'd be bored at home and separated from my friends. So you shouldn't take away any of my choices.
Okay, and that's another factor in this whole 14C argument, is that many of the people who are opposed to it don't understand that this is not a mandate. This is a choice. People want to be at supported work centers. I prefer to call them that because sheltered workshops have developed kind of this negative connotation, like a sweatshop or something, but they're not like that. They're providing very creative. These people who choose to work there as supervisors want to be there. They like working with people with handicaps, and they are creative. They're creating jobs all the time that help people become productive at their ability with their interest. The other thing is that, as Representative Hoden shared with you, she wants to set up a task force after the fact. to me, it would make sense to actually get the data and the research of the impacts of a law before you remove a law. This law is working for people. And in Minnesota, there's just there's like almost 10,000 people that are benefiting from the 14C provision. And by federal law, the Department of Employment and Economic Development has to annually interview everybody. In 2019, 9,900 people were interviewed by the state of Minnesota. 83% of them indicated satisfaction with their current working situation. They're not interested in competitive employment. That means we would displace nearly 10,000 Minnesotans if this were eliminated, if this provision was eliminated. We're not ready to do that. What are you going to do with all these people? And we're talking about people that cannot work in the competitive employment. And there's lots of them. And they're very happy where they are. Most people, and the laws have created transition from high school. We've got people that are in least restrictive environment, which means that they have to be provided all the way up to their main ability. They don't suddenly lose their handicap when they graduate from high school, but they still have to be transitioned by being tested to see if they can work in a competitive environment. And many of them can't. They've been unsuccessful. They've already tried, and they found that their productivity is not high enough to measure up to what most employers would expect, or their needs, you know, if they have a tantrum in the middle of a workplace, it just doesn't work. Additionally, last year, the 2020 Civil Rights Commission did a public comment period. 98% of almost 10,000, there were 10,000 submissions, which is like the highest they've seen in years, were in favor of retaining 14C. This is at the national level now, and we're talking thousands and thousands of people that will be affected by this. I'm a court-appointed legal guardian, as is Mr. Clapper, and we're entrusted, just like parents are, to look after our loved ones who have special needs. We have to come to terms ourselves with the limitations of our loved ones. And for anyone to tell me as a parent who's lived with this person that I value her less as a human being, to see every service that's available to her shut down with one sweeping law like this, every work center will be shut down. They will not be able to have the opportunity to work. And just because somebody qualifies for SSI does not mean that they aren't capable of work or that they aren't wanting to work. Laura has the choice every day to either exercise, do games, do crafts and activities. They have all these day activities there, but she also has the choice to work. And what do you choose to do?
I usually prefer to work because working's my choice.
Yeah, and working is something that gives people self-esteem. It helps them have a feeling of belonging. And truth be told, it is her civil right to pick and choose who she wants to be among. And if her friends also have disabilities, to say that, no, you're better off in the community as a minority. And truly, this group of people, disabled people, are the only ones that are being singled out systematically to say that you must be a minority among non-disabled people. This should be a choice. This is a civil right, a constitutional civil right to choose who you want to be among. And she chooses to be among her friends. And she loves to have supervisors that joke with her and understand her disabilities and celebrate them. Not all work supervisors can do that.
We're running very short on time, so if you could please wrap up, because I have three more test
fires. I will wrap it up.
We have members' questions.
The last point I want to make is that rural America, which is where we live, has limitations on jobs to begin with. And to expect that suddenly these jobs are going to pop up all across northern Minnesota and southern Minnesota that are tailored to the needs of handicapped people, not realistic. Not realistic at all. And to have some sort of work center where they have a community hub, we've got creative staff creating jobs for them that they are working at their own ability level and they're being compensated fairly. This isn't about making a living a wage. It's about quality of life. So on behalf of my daughter and her friends and coworkers, I'm urging you to understand that denial of options to work at their own abilities in a least restrictive environment where they can meet their full potential is just as discriminating as denying somebody the opportunity to work in competitive employment. No one is denying the opportunity to work in competitive employment, but elimination of 14C denies her and people who have needs at her ability to work at all. It's all or none. That's what capitalism is. So thank you so much for your time, and I'm sorry I went over time.
Thank you, Ms. Kvokovich and Laura. Next up is Jim Sillery, and members, we have 10 minutes left, so please be brief so we can get this
bill.
Mr. Sillery, please identify yourself for the record. You're muted, Mr. Sillery.
Okay. Thank you very much. First, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for taking my testimony and allowing me to share my perspectives on this issue. My name is Jim Sillery. I live in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And my direct experience in this matter is personal. I'm the parent of a young adult on the autism spectrum. We are on the spectrum, probably on the unfavorable side of middle of the road. And he's working at the Asplund Center in Plymouth, Minnesota. My personal perspective has also been broadened by a lot of things that I've done, including volunteer work with organizations like Opportunity Partners, Reach for Resources, and Special Olympics. In addition, I'm currently serving as a member of the DHS Technology First Advisory Task Force. The mission of that task force is to advise the commissioner on how to increase the use of technology by people with disabilities as prescribed by the Olmstead decision. My son Adam has been happily employed at the Asplund Center for over 8 years, and Asplund has been more than a place for Adam to work. In addition to its center-based employment program, Asplund provides adults with intellectual development disabilities with a broad range of programs to help develop life skills. It also serves as a community for Adam and for the other adults that go to Asplund, and friendships are made there and experiences are shared. And that's a key part of life for people with disabilities who don't have access to friendships and community like we do. All of this is made possible under the provisions of 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'd say during this period, I've seen Adam grow in confidence and self-esteem. He's a remarkable development. His ability to interact with others has increased significantly. And as I think about it, maybe this isn't surprising. As I research the origins of Section 14C, I find that it was originally intended to provide opportunity and choice to people with a disability to have the option to work for competitive wages. And in many cases, adults come out of school, out of transition, and they aren't prepared to do that. A center-based program like the one at Aspen provides the opportunity for training and the life skills necessary to work competitively. And as Mr. Clapper testified, there's many success stories, his son included. But they come out better prepared to provide performance. But not all of these adults can succeed in a competitive environment. My son Adam, for example, would be very, very difficult for him to work in a competitive environment where he would be expected to have productivity at that level. So a center-based program gives them a choice to work in an environment where they feel safe, they can work as part of a community, and have staff support. It's also cost-effective. I've lived in states where, without the choice of a center-based program, these adults just sit at home, and they create a financial and emotional burden on their families. The 14C provisions provides Adams and others with choices and opportunities to start employment and then steadily develop skills, self-confidence, and work ethics. If the restrictions of HF 439 are no longer in place, these choices and opportunities simply cease to exist. Businesses that contract out this work, if their intention is to provide cheap sources of labor, can just send the work overseas where cheap labor is abundant. In fact, it's interesting to see that many of these organizations are doing this not because the labor is cheap, because they understand what the productivity underlying it is. They're doing it because of altruistic reasons. Adam's story represents a large community of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are thriving under the provisions of 14C because they cannot succeed in a competitive environment. And as if HF 439 passes, they'll simply lose their employment. On behalf of my son, Adam, I ask you to reject HF 439. Not only will this bill reduce existing employment opportunities, it provides no new choices and opportunities to replace them. We're simply going to eliminate a program and have no solutions in place for the people that won't be able to be competitively employed. So I implore you to avoid fixing something that's not broken. Commensurate wages using the 14C provisions continue to serve the needs of our community. And thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Sillery. And I've got to remind the next two testifiers, we have 5 minutes left in committee, and we do have a member question. Christina Petrenko, Minnesota Legal Aid and Minnesota Disability Law Center. Ms. Petrenko, please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Eklund and committee members. My name is Christina Petrenko. I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, which is a statewide division of legal aid. We serve as the protection and advocacy system for people who have disabilities in Minnesota. Thank you, Representative Zhang and Representative Hassan, for your leadership on this important bill. We strongly support HF 439 and efforts to phase out subminimum wage in Minnesota. People who have disabilities can work in the community alongside people with and without disabilities earning minimum wage or higher. Wherever they choose to work, people who have disabilities deserve to be paid at least minimum wage for their work. Doing so is a human rights issue. Minnesota can phase out subminimum wage with good planning. Our office has researched this transition in other states. In several other states that have done it, people with disabilities experience significant advantages. They have earned higher wages, they're working in jobs and careers that match their interests, and they're forming relationships through work with coworkers and community members. Transitioning away from subminimum wage will take work and planning to ensure that people who have disabilities have the support they need to find and secure the jobs they choose, as well as opportunities to find meaningful non-work opportunities during the day. We will need to meet people's transportation needs and support service providers financially and with technical assistance to transform their employment services. Our day programming models will also need to offer integrated supports. Minnesota can meet the challenges of this transition. Many providers have already begun the shift, and we are grateful for our collaboration with Moore and others. HF 439 would establish a task force to develop a comprehensive plan before subminimum wage is phased out, and would allow 4 years of thoughtful transition to ensure that Minnesota has the time and planning to ultimately end subminimum wage in a way that allows people who have disabilities across Minnesota to access work, support, and services they need. Thank you very much, Chair Eklund, for your time today, and Representative Zhang and Representative Hassan for your leadership on this bill. I hope you will support HF 439.
Thank you, Ms. Petrenko, for your testimony. Next up is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. Ms. Hernandez-Wilson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair and members of committee, Representative Zhang and Hassan. As stated, my name is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. My pronouns are she, her. I live in St. Paul, work full-time, am an active community member, and proud disabled woman of color. When I was born, doctors told my mom that I was disabled. And when I was only a few days old, they prepared her to handle my condition by placing limits on my capacity for life. They set expectations for what I could and could not do, for who I would and would not become. Thank goodness she didn't listen, because they were wrong. I often wonder who I would be if she had listened. And as I grew up and made friends with other people with disabilities, I realized that that part of my story wasn't unique at all, because they too were given labels and diagnoses that attempted to frame who and what they could be. And that is part of how ableism works, through stereotypes and expectations, often perpetuated by society and even those closest to us, as you've heard today. Ableism can also be sustained through our laws. And when we have a law still in place 30 years after the ADA has passed, may I remind us, that allows those with intellectual and intellectual and developmental disabilities to be paid less than the rest, it says something about their value and worth in our society too. It says they aren't valued enough to be worthy of bare minimum wages. And in many cases, it binds people with intellectual and developmental disabilities into a life of forced poverty and isolation. And that's why it's so important that I urge you to support House File 439 and the phase out of subminimum wages in Minnesota. If people with disabilities can't even be paid minimum wages, when will they ever be seen as equals in our society? This bill will give our state time to develop a strategy that ensures no one who relies on these services are left behind, to ensure that they have the supports that are needed. Disability is not a monolith, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities must set and define their own limits instead of being told them, to be given supports that focus on their strengths and talents, to find employment that feels right for them, employment where they are paid competitive wages, given opportunities for growth and connection in an inter-abled workplace that is undoubtedly the future. I wish I had time to fully express how my presence has impacted the culture and community in my workplace, how coworkers start to notice when things aren't accessible, how their lens shifts and adjusts to be more diverse, equitable, and inclusive. Because individually customized and integrated employment goes beyond benefiting the person hired. It makes the entire workforce stronger, too. Providing a seat at the table, a chance to redefine what's possible, and a future that is reclaimed on our own terms is the bare minimum. And the time to act on that future is now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez-Wilson. Member questions, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to thank all the testifiers. It's been good to hear everybody's perspective. I understand that there's a lot of fear around this bill, and I could see why. I also know that states like, when I was looking this up and reading more about it, that Alaska, Maine, Maryland, Nevada, New Hampshire, and Vermont all have actually abolished the subminimum wage for people with disabilities. So it just, I guess, maybe legal aid the Disability Law Center has more information on what has happened in those states. I do appreciate the approach of having a report come to the legislature by 2023 and having a working group on this. I just want to make sure, though, that people that do have those fears, because these are real fears, right? Families are not wrong because they're worried about what's working for their kids. I just want to make sure that they have a seat at that table, too, if this actually does pass, because we don't all have to agree on this, but what we do have to make sure is that there's opportunities for people, and those are people with all different abilities. So thank you so much.
Representative Hassan, you have a comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate everyone's perspective on this, and I understand that when we talk about this issue and the people that are testifying today, some people are talking about their children. And some people are talking about their individual selves. And this is a tough issue, but we also have to think about this issue as a fairness issue. There are many, many reports that indicate that, you know, people with disabilities being isolated, being very vulnerable, being taken advantage of, and then the fact that they get paid at minimum wage. Those are all facts, but it's also a fact that when there is change, that it's okay to have the fear of not knowing what's going to happen. But I would highly encourage that family members and the disability community, as well as the advocates, come together and have conversation around this issue so we can come up with a solution that works for everybody. But I truly believe eliminating the subminimum wage is the right thing to do, as well as keeping everyone's, you know, concerns at the center and the heart of this issue.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not a supporter of this bill, 439. I think I would like to thank Mr. Clapper and Ms. Kovalchevich and Sillery, Mr. Sillery, for coming in and testifying. I would also encourage any legislators to go visit a center. I have a center in Forest Lake, Minnesota. And as soon as I was invited, I walked through the doors and I was pulled in all different directions by the people that were working there, these young people with and elderly people with disabilities or special needs. And they wanted me to learn about the work that they were doing and how they were doing it and how they felt part of the community. I think this is a great program that we have going, and I just support those types of programs, and thank you to those testifiers that came and spoke today. Thank you so much.
Representative Bliss, you had your hand up. Have your questions been answered?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They're fine. I don't need to ask. Okay.
All right. No, seeing no other member questions, Representative Hassan, you want to make final comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I want to thank everyone. And Representative Detmer, I have visited several centers, and I have seen the work that goes on. And I still support eliminating the subminimum wage. I still support that we pay people a fair wage for the work that they're doing, and that we support our disabled community and folks, and that we see them as human beings, as individuals, and as contributing members and productive members of our society. And with that, I know the bill is going to be laid over and it has some work to do. I am sure Rep. Xiong will continue to work with the families as well as the advocates to make this bill better and much stronger. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. I will renew my motion that House File 439 be laid over for possible inclusion on this bill. The bill is laid over. Members, thank you for your patience. Thank you for the testimony. Very passionate on all sides on these issues. Our next meeting is Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. Any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Have a good weekend.